Welcome to another edition of the New Hampshire Journal podcast brought to you by the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy. Over at the JBC, the big dog is Drew Klein, who, by the way, actually owns two big dogs, if I recall correctly.
My youngest son is going as a fox for Halloween. Our newest dog is a foxhound. That has caused some hilarity in the house.
I believe it. It should.
He's very confused about this giant fox running around.
By the way, great event with Jim Pendle, formerly of New Hampshire Journal. Now at some second,
right.
Now is at some second rate rag in Boston, the Globe or something. And right. And our good buddy Jim Garrity from National Review. We are going to turn that into a special edition podcast to be released sometime Friday for people's weekend enjoyment.
Excellent. I think everybody will enjoy it. It was a good time.
It was great. A lot of analysis of the polls. Speaking of polls, four polls dumped today, I think. You had ARG, and you had UNH, and you had St. A's, and you had, what am I saying?
UMass Lowell.
UMass Lowell, yeah. They all. So what would you say the headlines from the polling of New Hampshire?
You know, Sununu's getting away with it. Trump is still unpopular, and Biden's got still a 9-10 point lead. The most eye-opening number, or the one that would surprise people the most, I think, is the UNH poll showing Maurer's up by two. But
that's the first congressional district Republican Matt Maurer's right. Running against incumbent Chris Pappas, who has had a tough week, and you wonder if it's had some impact.
According to the UNH poll, Pappas's numbers have fallen steadily since September. Mm-hmm. So if that poll is to be believed, and look, the numbers are within the margin of error, and sure. I looked down the crosstabs, and they seem to undersample Democrats mm-hmm. in that poll. So take all the caveats and everything, sure, exactly. But I think that'll get some headlines.
And I think that it's certainly reasonable to think that that race could be tightening in the in what was until recently the swingiest district in the country. And I don't mean that in the fun way. I mean that in the Republican to Democrat to Republican to Democrat in, you know, that congressional seat.
Everybody says the race is tightening. Yeah. And Maurer's has done a great job campaigning, you know, mm-hmm. like or dislike his aggression. Sure. You know, James Pendle on our show today said, on our event today, right. said he's run a perfect campaign.
Yeah.
He's run a great campaign.
Yeah, I agree. And do you also have the impact of if people who are swing voters, maybe they vote Republican 6 out of 10 times, but they're not happy with Trump, they may be thinking, I don't want everybody down there to be, you know, a right. Biden Democrat. And so I think you may see that effect across the country and maybe a little of it here. Now, can I tell you my favorite number because I'm a jerk?
Yeah, you tell me your favorite and then I'll tell you my favorite.
Okay, my favorite number from the polls today, the St. A's poll showing that the same percentage of Granite Staters have some favorable view of Democrat Dan Feltes as a percentage of Granite Staters who have no idea who he is or no opinion. So it's 33% approved, 33%. I don't know who the hell this guy is. And that's just tough. That's just tough sledding. And it shows that when you're a state legislator in New Hampshire with 400 members of the House and with relatively small senatorial districts, it's just tough to get your name out there, even though political geeks like us, Drew, we all know about yeah. Senator Feltes.
I mean, we actually know him,
exactly.
And like him. He's a good guy.
He's a nice guy.
You know, and it also doesn't help if you can't raise money because your opponent is so incredibly popular, which leads to my favorite number, 70. 70 is the percentage of people in the UMass Lowell poll who said the country is on the wrong track. That's wow. a lot
wow.
of people saying that. 71 is the percentage that Sununu pulls for his job approval. So 70% say the country's on the wrong track. Obviously, that includes a lot of Republicans who say the country's on the wrong track or Republican-leaning independents. And yet, Sununu is not touched by any of that, none of it, mm-hmm. Which I think is fascinating. His popularity, his favorability rating is 65%. He beats Bill Belichick, who's at 54%.
In fact, the only institution in the state of New Hampshire that's more popular than Governor Chris Sununu is?
Grocery stores, Hannaford and Market Basket. Market Basket is the king of New Hampshire with 90% approval.
What?
Which would make it more popular than, according to national polls, Hershey's, and Major League Baseball.
That's incredible, particularly since they still are putting the sticky on the wrong part of the bag at some of the stores. And I thought Sununu would fix that, so I'm very annoyed. Look, we have a ton of great guests on the podcast, so I want to get to them, including the most talked about pollster in America, Robert Cahaley, is going to join us, and Ilya Shapiro, who has a terrific new book out about the Supreme Court. And he's going to comment on what the impacts of the court and elections and blah, blah, blah. But I got to ask you about what for me was a surprise announcement at the presser today with Governor Sununu. He announced that the state is going to require, if you want to eat out at a restaurant, you have to give your name and your personal contact information, and the restaurant has to track your time of arrival.
Yeah.
Or you cannot legally dine out in New Hampshire. This kicks in this Saturday. And I was genuinely taken aback by it. It seemed to kind of come out of nowhere. And I was just wondering what you thought of this.
I'm not terribly, I mean, there was no warning, but I'm not terribly surprised. New Hampshire is the only New England state that has not been doing, only Northern New England state that's not been doing that. Vermont and Maine have both been doing it since March. So it's, or May. And it's a common practice, I think, in a lot of states and a lot of places around Europe and Asia, to do contract tracing like that. So if you go to a restaurant, they just want to know. They're not trying to track you in some government conspiracy. They're just trying to make sure that if they have an outbreak at that restaurant, they can find out who was sitting at what tables so they can test you and reach out to you and say you have symptoms, right? It's just a matter of to try to control the spread. So I'm not surprised at all. And the fact that the restaurant association asked for it, is also not surprising. As Mike Summers, who runs the restaurant association, said, is they're just trying to do their part.
No, well, actually I talked to Mike, and he let us know that the restaurants are dying under these announcements, you know, the public where you have seven cases at this restaurant. Well, as soon as the restaurant hears that on the news, they just go, well, we're done for the next 2 weeks.
Well, he's right. And this is why I think it's not a surprise that the restaurants asked for it. So we've had a couple of outbreaks at clusters is the right word, at restaurants. And whenever you see that, it not only hurts that restaurant, it hurts other restaurants. Mm-hmm. So if restaurants can step up and say, look, we're going to help with the contact tracing. And it's very similar to just individual citizens saying, okay, we'll wear masks. We'll do this, right? Just to help out, just to slow the spread, just to help the economy.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the voice of big government, Drew Klein, your big stomping F. What do they call you? FDR, man. You just want the government to take over everything, because there is a huge difference between the restaurant association saying, we are going to do this, or encouraging our members to do this. Yeah. We're going to have a database, and a government mandate. There is only one way to enforce a government mandate, and that is with law enforcement, arrests, fines, penalties, pulling your health license, et cetera, which is why when New Hampshire Journal, we have a story up about this at nhjournal.com, asked the governor and the association about enforcement. They didn't want to talk about it. It's going to be fine. It's just going to, no. What's going to happen is someone's going to walk in a restaurant, and the restaurant's going to say, I want to know your name and how to get a hold of you. And they're going to say, you know, there are things I want you to kiss that are not readily apparent. And then there's going to be an issue. And this is why the government stepping in is a problem. What happens if a restaurant doesn't collect it? What happens if a customer doesn't want to hand it over? Government orders always create problems. And I think you're going to, here's my prediction. In a couple months, the state is going to wish they hadn't done this. But in the short term, it's what the voters want to see, because voters really are still afraid of COVID-19, and they love get tough policies. And so this is a political winner, but a policy faux pas, in my opinion.
Again, the restaurants asked for it, and I think they asked for it because they want to be able to have a uniform policy across the state. Look, I tend to agree with you. Look, on everything you said about government mandates and all that, but we are in a pandemic, and those sorts of public health policies are generally widely accepted in a pandemic as opposed to in any other situation, right? So if you were just going to ask for this kind of information any other time, right, it would be outrageous.
Well, we'll see. We'll see how it works out.
These are not policies designed to control you as an individual. They're not trying to trace you, to track your movement so the government knows where you are so they can take your guns. This is, in case there's an outbreak, we need to identify it so we're protecting others. That's the point.
Ladies and gentlemen, when the government agent is putting that chip into your neck, just remember that they were cheered on by Drew Klein. Just remember that.
Hey, I'm not saying I like it.
I'm kidding. Come on.
But once again, as a legal matter, it's acceptable. It's legally acceptable.
That doesn't mean
we have to like it.
Well, it's interesting because the folks at Reopen New Hampshire reminded me that the state of New Hampshire just passed a personal privacy amendment to the Constitution. And it's an amendment that has yet to be tested. In other words, no one's brought anything to be bounced off of it. So I don't know. Well, it's once the government acts, all sorts of other unintended dominoes start falling. And so we'll see where this ends up. Meanwhile, be safe out there. Wear your mask. Be smart. You know a great way to be smart, Drew Klein? Listen to largely your interview with Robert Cahaly, the most talked about pollster in America today. Robert Cahaly of the Trafalgar Group, welcome to the New Hampshire Journal podcast. My first question is about social desirability bias. It is at the center of this way that you do polling that's different from everyone else. What is it and why is it so important?
Well, I'll say this. It's not the only thing. There's a few other things we do different that I think are also very important in this. But let me run through what those two things are, because I think that'll put it all in a little bit more perspective.
Sure.
The other is, we don't believe in long questionnaires. I think this idea that an average person can answer the phone at 7 o'clock, whether they're putting their children to bed or they're washing dishes, and the number one question they're going to ask is, how long is this going to take? And when the answer comes back, 20 minutes, 10 minutes, they're going to hang up. So we believe in short questionnaires. I want to get you on and off our poll in under 3 minutes, because I think that if you don't do that, you're only polling people who are way too deep in, who are too high in their knowledge of politics and care too much about politics, and on the left or the right, or frankly, they're just bored. So I think we lower the ability for average people to participate, I think, is very critical. And second, our universes of who we're going to speak to are made up differently. We look at voters, as we did in 2016, that fit some characteristics. We saw people who had come out in the primaries who had not voted in a long time. This is going to be another election where low propensity voters are going to be voting, and making sure that people that could vote, that might very well vote based on some patterns we've seen recently, are considered in your polling, I think is incredibly important. And we make sure that those low propensities are in our polling. Now, as far as the social desirability bias, what that is people's unwillingness to say something uncomfortable to the person asking the question. If they perceive it to be uncomfortable, somebody may ask you, hey, they put on a horrible shirt. What do you think of the shirt? Now, they know it's horrible. But you say, oh, yes, it's okay, because you don't want to offend them. Because you don't know that they're like, well, I think the shirt sucks. Why didn't you tell me it sucks? But it doesn't matter, because people want to be polite. Well, with everything going on, nobody wants to be judged by being for Trump. We see it all the time. We saw it 4 years ago. They were called deplorable. This year, that's the nicest thing that's said. And, I mean, we talk to people every day, and sometimes you have to, build a little bit of rapport with folks. And if you get to know people, they'll tell you where they really feel, but they're not telling a stranger they're for Trump. People that are very much for Trump say, well, I don't just tell anybody on the phone for Trump. I don't know what they're going to do with that. I don't know who they are. And there's a lot of that going on. And it's rampant. I mean, we're seeing people persecuted for their political beliefs. We've seen people get beat up for wearing a certain kind of hat, their house getting attacked for a certain kind of sign, their car getting destroyed just because they had a sticker on it. I mean, you can understand why somebody would be hesitant to tell a stranger on the phone who they're for. I mean, I hear it all the time. Is that tape going to be on YouTube? I mean, are these people really polling? I mean, sometimes they ask, are you guys really pollsters, And we'll tell them, hey, stop right now. Go Google us. That's us. We're real. And you'd be surprised when people actually stop Google the company and come back and say, okay. Or they'll say, yeah, we saw that you say, we'll say we saw that you said that Trump was going to win. Yeah, we're for Trump. We just don't want to tell anybody else.
I would like to hear your answer, though, to the how people should perceive the potential of the gap, in particular, based on the polling you've done in Pennsylvania, which has an interesting mix of really urban voters, you know, blue suburban voters, and truly rural blue collar voters.
Well, we find the same thing a lot of places. One, our most recent poll, I believe we showed Trump up, and he is up based on one main factor. The undecided, the people who were kind of hemming and hawing, saying, well, you know, maybe I'm from one of the other candidates, maybe I'm going to vote for Jorgensen, I'm undecided, and the black community are gone. They have all consolidated behind Trump. We are showing him in multiple places. Just his number is climbing. I think Pennsylvania, he was up to 13 or 14. Some of the states, he's in the 20s with the black vote. I mean, it really is increasing, and we're seeing young people are starting to move over this. Biden is perceived as the way to fight the virus is shutdowns. Wouldn't rule out shutdowns. Trump is, hey, we can wear a mask, we can wash our hands, but we can go back to school, we can get back to life, we can restore the economy. And that is a message that even among young people who don't like him, make them inclined to vote for him. And among suburban women who don't like his personality, they like those kids being home and, you know, them not being able to pursue what they want to during the day. I mean, I talk to ladies all the time who are in careers, and that, you know, I mean, one particular one was a salesperson, and she's like, the men in my office are way ahead of me because I can't go to work. I got kids that used to be in school. They, you know, they had extracurricular. I drop them off at 8. Pick them up at 5, and I was just as competitive as the guys in this company, and now I'm here all day, and the kids aren't getting any better, and I'm falling behind in my career, and it's terrible, and I don't like Trump, but if he's against this, I'm for him.
So, Robert, people who are upset by the outcome of your polling, who appear to be worried that you've discovered something or who want to explain it all the way, say, hey, it's just as likely that you've got a hidden Biden vote as it is a hidden Trump vote. Are you running into any evidence that there are people who are reluctant to say that they're voting for Joe Biden outside of his, you know, own family members?
No, we haven't gotten that impression. And because here's the thing, there's the difference between I'm for Biden and I live in a neighborhood with a bunch of Trump signs and I'm not putting a Trump sign. And I wouldn't say Biden on a survey. There's a different level of hiddenness. Okay. It's one thing to just not put a sign in your yard because you don't feel like dealing with the neighbors not being mad at you. It's another thing that you don't want to be judged. Nobody, you don't get judged for being for Biden. Nobody is on the phone with a caller and they go, that guy said he was for Biden. He must be up such and such. I mean, this doesn't exist. Now, I did predict, and I believe this would have been the case, had Bernie Sanders had been the Democrat nominee, there would be moderate Democrats who would not be willing to admit they were voting for Bernie. So I don't think it's a one-way thing, but I think Biden has a very middle-of-the-road reputation, and, you know, nobody is, you know, beating up somebody for wearing a Build Back Better hat.
Hey, Drew Klein at the Josiah Bartlett Center, you got a question for Robert Cahaley?
Yeah, I do.
Sure.
Hey, thanks for joining us. My employer is the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, and it's named after a physician who became a Revolutionary War hero. And he was known at the time for being contrarian and all kinds of things. And he had a saying that he would give advice to young people, don't afraid to be wrong. And he was one of the early advocates for inoculation and was pretty controversial at the time for that. And he was right. And there's a certain courage it takes to buck conventional wisdom at the cost of your reputation. And I'm just wondering how you wound up pushing this company out there to take on the status quo of the polling industry by doing things differently.
Well, I mean, it started in 2016. I mean, we were certain we started doing polling ourselves in 2008 because we just weren't satisfied at what we were paying for. So we started doing it ourselves, and kind of a lot of this is self-taught. I've had a lot of good people work with me over the years, and we learned some things. Michael, I talk about how I learned from some things from Rod Cheeley.
Absolutely.
Raju, we taught me the neighbor question. And I always give him credit, unlike those other scurrilous pollsters who use it without giving us credit, and they know who they are. we had to learn to do some of this, and so we started studying how it was done, and we came to some early conclusions about the long questionnaires. That was the first thing that we really noticed. You just didn't end up getting average people because people's lives are busy. And it's like, it's kind of old fashioned to think that, you know, people are sitting around in the parlor waiting on the phone to ring so they might participate in a political survey. I mean, nobody has that kind of time. And so that was part of it. And we started seeing the different technology could play, and the anonymity technology allows it. And what you find is the more anonymous someone is, the more honest they are. People, you know, everybody has kind of, you know, two sides of their personality, the side they show the world and the side that's what they really think. And we're in a society where those sides are hit, are different than they've probably ever been. And the second was hidden more than it's probably ever been. But the one that's hidden is the one that goes and votes. And I'm trying to get to what you really think, not what you say you think. And so that's one of the things we discovered that we could do and delve into a little more. And so we ask additional questions that help kind of quietly reveal where you really are and put people at a comfort level. And I'm also a believer in talking to average people. So we spend a lot of time like following up people, talking to people, having long conversations, learning about their lives and why they think what they think. I mean, as Lee Atwater would say, putting yourself in Joe Sixpack's head, figuring out what average people think and ignoring what political people say. So we thought we built a better mousetrap in 2016. And we got out there and we talked to some of the different groups that publicize this, and we said we think we got something different. In the primaries, we ended up really shocking people getting it right. So by the fall, we were ready to go out there and compete. And everybody was saying, you're crazy, it's going to be wrong. You know, and I just said, hey, next Wednesday I'm going to be the guy who got it right, or nobody's going to listen to me anymore. And I feel like if I don't stand up for what I think is real and what I see, then what difference does it make? The upside is too big. And I mean, I've had to start over again a few times in life. I'm willing to risk on what I believe is right and what I believe is the accurate. I think these guys are the Pony Express, and they're attacking those telegraph lines.
I noticed that you had Trump up in Pennsylvania by a little bit, and your sample was it was more than 50% women, and men were around 46%. And all the other polls are telling us that women are, you know, 2-1 or more in favor of Biden. Do you think there's a hidden voter among women that the other polls aren't picking up as well?
The number one most likely hidden voter is an upper income woman who has children. That's the number one person who is going to tell you they're not for Trump who is. That's our number one hidden voter. Our number two used to be a single black male under 50. Now, in the last week, those guys have moved from hidden to out front. They are, I say that the shy voters in the black community are not shy anymore. So the number two most likely hidden voter is going to be a white male, upper income, with children at home.
Kahaley, we were talking to David Paleologos on the New Hampshire Journal podcast, and he said that one of the groups that, if Trump, you know, surprises everybody, one of the groups where you're going to see movement is black men. That he's seeing that in his polling as well. Isn't that what he said, Drew? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, he did. Yep.
It's huge. And Pennsylvania was the smallest jump. I mean, we're talking about over 26% in North Carolina, over 28% in Florida, high 20s in Nevada, over 25 in Michigan. These are unheard of numbers, and they were in the teens, like Pennsylvania's and all those states, a week and a half ago. But a lot of what we're hearing from people is they saw the 50 cent thing, regardless of what he did afterwards. They saw it. They've seen other things. You know, they've seen nice things being said by ISP. They've seen outreach. But they were watching this debate, and Trump went through a litany of things he did for the Black community. And what they're telling me is, I didn't believe it, so I Googled it. And then they saw it was real. And they start asking the question, well, wait a minute. Did he really do this stuff for the Black colleges? Did he really do this stuff for the criminal justice reform? Is this platinum plan? Like, they're hearing this one after the other, and they're like, and what has this guy done for us? I mean, it is significant. And I think if Trump wins this, and I think he will owe this segment of the Black community this election, because other segments in Republicans have been relying on, Trump is not relying on this year. And so this will be anyone who tries to suggest that if Trump has this victory, who tries to take away credit from the Black community delivering him this victory will not be intellectually honest.
We really appreciate your time. And I know you got to run. One last question for you. Looking out across the country on Tuesday night, the one state that you think will be the biggest surprise in favor of Trump and the one state you think will be the biggest surprise in favor of Biden?
I don't think there are many big surprises.
Well, you know, for a lot of people, if Trump wins more than 10 states, that'll be a surprise. So keep the average listener in mind, Kaylee.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess right. I get them. I would say that when they see the returns coming in from Pennsylvania and Trump doing very well. Again, I'm not saying before it's all said and done he'll end up winning Pennsylvania, because I believe he has to win Pennsylvania by at least four to not have it stolen from him. But I think the numbers who get on election day will be significant, and that will surprise people. And I think that I think it's going to shock people in Biden. I mean, the bar has been set so high for Biden, I don't really see a shocking state being for Biden.
Will he win something surprising like Arizona? Well, I know Arizona's not a surprise, but like a traditional Republican state like Arizona or Georgia, something like that?
Yeah, he ain't going to win Georgia. Come on. He ain't going to win. Listen, if you had 30 people at an event, you have 30 people to barbecue and it's a failure in Georgia. Come on.
Robert Cahaley, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Good to talk to you, sir.
Well, that was a fun interview. And like I said in the interview, I think one of the most interesting things about his company is that he's willing to take a risk in the market. He's willing to risk his reputation on his beliefs that this way of doing polling works better than the standard way that other pollsters do. And that's just a wonderful thing that shows that competition in the marketplace can be really helpful. If he's successful, then we've discovered a better way to poll people. If he fails, as he admits, then, you know, he fails and he was wrong. And that's the market speaking, which is great.
And what's so funny about that is that when I knew Cahaley back in my misspent youth, he was a total operative. In other words, the polling and numbers and stuff like data crunching, that was somebody else's job. His job was to, you know, dig through the opponent's trash to find the embarrassing photographs. And now, because like you said, it's the market. He was, you know, got to win campaigns, got to have good data to win them. And he decided, I'm not happy with the polling I'm getting. I'm going to start making my own. And the rest is history.
Yeah, we all grow as we get older.
Except me.
Well, some of us.
Exactly. Thank you. Hey, who's coming up next?
Up next is Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute. He's a legal scholar there. And we have him on for one reason, because he has a new book out about the Supreme Court and nominations and how this works. And another reason, because he recently wrote an interesting piece about voter fraud and voter suppression. And his conclusion is neither really exist at a large scale. So we thought he'd be fun to talk to, and here he is. All right, we are here with Cato Institute scholar Ilya Shapiro, who has written a new book about judicial nominations, but also a provocative new piece at the Cato Institute about voter suppression and voter fraud. And I thought he'd be a great guest to have on right now, right before the election, to talk about his take on those two issues. In New Hampshire, we deal with claims about voter fraud, and the last couple of years, claims about voter suppression. And Ilya's take might surprise some of you. So can you give us your theory that you just wrote about?
Yeah, this is a piece I put up on The Federalist, where I appear from time to time. I'm a senior contributor there. basically arguing that both parties' political leaders have heightened even more, unfortunately, the tensions that we all feel over the election, over our public discourse more broadly. We have a low level of social trust these days, a low level of confidence in our institutions. And what we get from kind of political leaders is from the right cries of voter fraud and from the left cries of voter suppression. But when you look at the last number of election cycles, there's really not much of that. So no election is perfect because it's run by humans and humans are imperfect. There's going to be incompetence. There's going to be maladjustment to new procedures, particularly in this COVID year when most states are rolling out new processes and procedures, new places to vote, new protocols, a lot more mail-in ballots, obviously absentee, etc. So there could be things going wrong, not necessarily nefarious, not necessarily fraudulent, but just adjusting to the new normal or the temporary abnormal, however you have it. But nothing that I've seen leads to the idea that you can have to the charge that there is some sort of systemic, nefarious, malignant force based from the right, the left, or anyone else to stop people from voting who want to vote, to stop them from registering, to double count people, to fraudulently send ballots. At the local level, we certainly have seen these things do turn up in city council elections and localities. Patterson, New Jersey had a rift of things of fraud and things like that, as well as more broadly, mail not being delivered on time and voters being confused about, again, new processes and things like that. But at the end of the day, we may have litigation if there are close states or close results. That's understandable given the stakes of the matter. But I think we just need to turn it down a little bit in terms of blaming, this, that, and the other for losing an election.
So in New Hampshire, we have had a couple of recent stories of voter fraud. We've had a couple of prosecutions, some out-of-state folks from pretty far out-of-state voting in the 2016 election and getting prosecuted. And yet we have rumors that have popped up year after year after year of busloads of people being bused in to New Hampshire with Massachusetts plates. And it turns out, it's a political party in New Hampshire or an organization in New Hampshire renting a bus. And of course, it happens to have mass plates because there aren't any big bus rental companies around here, or aren't that many. So what you're saying is that sort of mass scale of voter fraud, there's just no evidence for, while individual cases will pop up from time to time.
Yeah, there could even be issues with congressional districts. I mean, at the highest level, there are some questions, for example, in the 2018 midterm elections where there were a number of seats in California that it looked like on election day, the day after, that the Republican candidate was in the lead. But then the late count came in and reversed that. Part of that is just the way that California counts ballots. Part of it is ballot harvesting, which is questionable if you don't put any restrictions on who can submit ballots and how many. But again, California obviously is not in play for the national presidential election, for Senate races, that sort of thing. I'm not familiar, obviously, with the local things on the ground in New Hampshire, and certainly the smaller scale election you get, the more a chance that fraud can happen. But between the structures in place, where the Electoral College, for example, prevents voter fraud. If we just had a national popular vote, then you could see precincts or states or localities that were heavily red or heavily blue just be able to run up the vote without a lot of supervision. But because we allow different states to run their processes in different ways, and the Electoral College is what ultimately decides, that's a break against trying to hack the election or defraud it in some way. For that matter, if you talk about international fraud or interference with the election, what the Russians, or perhaps this year the Chinese, the Iranians, who knows, what they do is sow discord and make us hate each other more, and kind of they're more of a chaotic force than they are necessarily pro one side or the other.
Right. And I like your point about the Electoral College. I don't think a lot of people think about it that way, but you've made the point that, look, in 2016, you had the election come down to a few states that no one would have predicted. People thought it was going to be Florida or North Carolina, and it wound up being some, you know, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. And so predicting where these things will be close enough to engage in some shenanigans that'll flip a few thousand votes or fraudulently stack the boxes, stuff the boxes with a few thousand votes to tip the election, it's just impossible to predict when you have the Electoral College versus, you know, if it was a winner-take-all popular vote, it wouldn't be quite so hard to do that.
That's exactly right. That's perhaps the strongest practical argument for the Electoral College, that to really sway the election, you would have to target 10 or 12 states who each have different kinds of procedures and processes and defraud them in somewhat different ways all at the same time without being detected. It's very hard to do, especially given the armies of lawyers that both parties have and are, you know, staging at this point, getting ready to file their lawsuits. And we've seen the spate of Supreme Court rulings going this way and that, not on any fraudulent or suppression issues, but on state courts acting or federal district courts acting to extend deadlines and consideration of postmarks and all these things. Look, I'm not arguing that we're not going to have litigation, at least if it's a close election. But I think this is simply a function of it being close and there being high stakes and election officials not having done a good job in administering perhaps or letting voters know about new processes or not putting in new procedures in place in time, given the unusual circumstances of the pandemic.
But in terms of wide-scale voter suppression, and we hear that in New Hampshire a lot just by virtue of the fact that we want to make it, one party wants to make the residency requirements solid so that you actually have to be a resident of New Hampshire. And the other party wants to make it looser so you can live in New Hampshire but not be a resident to vote here. And then you hear about Georgia, I think, is the most famous one, right? I mean, we still hear that the duly elected governor of Georgia was never seated from last time around. What do you make of those claims of widespread voter suppression?
Yeah, it seems like Democrats especially talk about Republicans being sore losers and not recognizing elections. And yet Georgia, I think, is the biggest example of not accepting results. And, supposed governor in exile, Stacey Abrams, talking about the illegitimacy of the election and so forth. Look, as long as the rules are clear and as long as those who are eligible to vote are able to vote without undue burden, meaning have access to getting an ID and all these challenges to state ID laws, by the way, they generally fail as long as it's, you don't have to go through some, convoluted process reminiscent of Jim Crow to be able to get a voter ID. As long as you're able to do that, then you're just having to show it at the polling places is not a problem. I think those who cry voter suppression at the first hint of long lines are really doing a disservice, and they're sowing just as much distrust and misinformation as those who cry voter fraud just because there's a couple of ballots that go missing or are misplaced or the election official doesn't know how to handle because of new procedures or what have you. For the most part, including and especially in those states that have changed their procedures since the Shelby County case in 2013 allowed a lot of jurisdictions to change their rules without getting pre-cleared by the Justice Department in Washington. These things, administrators get a lot of leeway, and unless you show that they're targeting racial minorities or in some other ways discriminating, just having a requirement to register or certain hours of voting, there are plenty of blue states that don't have any early voting whatsoever, for example. So I think there's just a lot to do about nothing, and a lot of our voter fraud versus voter suppression fights are inside the beltway or legal elite type things that don't reflect what's actually going on the ground.
You have a book just out called Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court, where you do a basically a history
of these highly charged political fights over Supreme Court nominations. And it's perfectly timed. So congratulations on that. And I think for our viewers or listeners who might not know how far this goes back, why don't you just start with, this isn't anything new, having these highly partisan court battles, right?
Yeah, the publisher had to pay extra for this timing. I mean, my book's release date was 4 days after Justice Ginsburg died. It was, you know, I thought when we were planning this, we wanted to get it out ahead of the election. That was our thought process. I submitted my manuscript at the end of March. And I was sort of like on pins and needles, you know, what if there's a vacancy, you know, a month after I submit, when it goes to press, are we going to be outdated? And here it hit exactly as the crisis came about, as the vacancy came about.
Have you been interviewed by the FBI about that?
I emailed the CEO of my publisher, Regnery. I'm like, Tom, do you have an alibi for last Friday? and he said, well, there's nothing I won't do for my authors. But look, politics has always been a part of the judicial nomination and confirmation process. After all, the Constitution says the president, who's a politician, shall nominate, and with the advice and consent of the Senate, senators are politicians, shall appoint judges on the Supreme Court. That's all the Constitution says. And from the very beginning, presidents have had to think about, do they have support in the Senate, factions in their party, regional balance, eventually the issue of slavery, the issue of railroad regulation, Reconstruction, the industrial era, party realignment of various kinds. I mean, world wars, lots of different issues have come up for politics to rear its head in different ways. What's different now isn't that you have some judges, justices, or nominees rejected or not acted upon. We've had all of those kinds of scenarios in our long history. What's different is, first, you have a very powerful federal government and therefore a powerful Supreme Court to rule on issues that get centralized that, you know, 150 years ago would have been decided at the state or local level, or even within the federal government 50 years ago would have been decided by Congress rather than being punted into the administrative state, the executive branch. But at the same time, you have very different, divergent interpretive theories of the Constitution, of statutory law that map onto partisan preferences at a time when the parties are more ideologically sordid or polarized than they've been since at least the Civil War. So whenever you have one of these very powerful, precious seats open up, it goes to DEFCON 1. You have this zero-sum game, fraught partisan battle. And frankly, the question of who controls the Senate and whether that's the same party as the president matters a lot. I mean, it seems like a banal point, but historically, when you have united government, that's led to about a 90% confirmation rate. When you've had divided government, it's less than 60%. And that difference is even greater in presidential election years. Vacancies, this is now the 30th time we've had a vacancy in a presidential election year. When we have united government, Senate and White House, 17, sorry, now as of this week, 18 of 20 confirmed, and with divided government, only 2 of 10. So look, there's very little new under the sun, and a lot of this is just bare knuckle politics.
And there's nothing unusual or untoward about getting a nominee through in an election year, right? I mean, that's just that it happens a lot.
That happens a lot. It hasn't happened this close to an election, so that's somewhat new. But we've had, for example, recess appointments within a month of the election. We've had lame duck confirmations after the president has lost his bid for reelection.
John Marshall.
Imagine, you know, would it have been John Marshall? Exactly. John Adams lost to Thomas Jefferson and nominated and had confirmed John Marshall, the great Chief Justice. Would it have been more controversial or more or less legitimate to hold off on the Barrett nomination process until after the election if the Republicans had lost either or both the White House and the Senate? Who knows? You can game theory these out, but at the end of the day, this is a political argument that both parties are making to voters. And generally, the types of judges that Republicans appoint, at least in the modern era, are popular. The articulation of originalism and textualism, reading the law for what it is, reading constitutional provisions for what they meant when they were enacted, that is more popular than, which is generally what comes from Republicans, than the Democratic formulation of seeking justice and the Constitution as a living document that grows and evolves as our social mores do, which is why you have kind of this asymmetric treatment of this issue between the parties.
So what can we as just American citizens do about this problem of these increasingly partisan fights, this highly charged atmosphere? Is there anything that the public can do to really ratchet this down and maybe make it a little more civil?
Well, if you buy my book, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court, you can understand this dynamic better. And believe me, the book is not about detailed, complicated jurisprudence. This is for the lay reader. It's about history and politics, a little bit of law that you need to understand the substance of these fights. But educate yourself and learn who the Supreme Court reporters are. So, whether you read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the, you know, you're the Boston Globe in New Hampshire or whatever the case might be, learn who the experts are in terms of the legal beat rather than someone parachuted in who normally covers the White House or Congress or healthcare or whatever the case might be, because those folks are not going to be able to break down what actually is going on. And they're going to treat this as more of a political judgment like anything else.
Well, I appreciate that plug. You beat me to it. So that was great. Where can people find your book?
Well, any place they buy books online or in person. I will say that if you go to supremedisorder.com, not only will you find links to a variety of places to buy it, but also for free, you can download a 20-page statistical historical appendix. So you can really nerd out on all of the Supreme Court and some of the lower court nominations that we've had in our history. Will make you really popular at your next Zoom cocktail party. and also, Drew, all your listeners, if you do buy my book, which is available in different versions, Audible and Kindle, in addition to the hardcover and CD and whatnot, I'm happy to send you a signed book plate. You know, can't get up there to sign it in person, but I can mail you a fancy sticker you can stick inside.
Oh, that sounds good. Well, you had me sold on the nerdy attachment. That's right at my alley. Well, Ilya Shapiro, thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate it. And keep up the good work up there at Cato.
Thank you. Take care.
So we have now just laid out way too much podcast for any one person to consume here in the Granite State. Don't you agree, Drew?
We've gorged on podcasts.
And yet we've got dessert coming tomorrow with that special edition podcast, the great conversation you had with Jim Pendle from the Boston Globe and Jim Garrity from National Review. It's excellent. Can't wait for that to post up. And you can find that at your website,
jbartlett.org.
And at nhjournal.com, the New Hampshire Journal. He's Drew Klein with the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy. I'm Michael Graham with the New Hampshire Journal. Thanks so much for listening to this edition of the New Hampshire Journal Podcast.